From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has been missing for a week. How do families cope?
It's the most painful kind of loss there is right now because you have no assurance of the fate of your loved one.
Some lawmakers want the military to consider changing a long-standing uniform policy against long hair and beards to accommodate religious beliefs.
It took nearly 15,000 petitioners. It took 50 congressional signatures. It took pressure from the White House.
And how a wardrobe malfunction launched a career.
Everyone was screaming, "Get art department! Let's figure this out!"
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. By its nature, the Central Intelligence Agency operates in the shadows. Even the members of Congress who oversee the agency rarely speak publicly about the agency's activities. So it was an extraordinary moment when the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee took to the floor of the Senate this week to condemn the CIA for snooping into its files.
I have asked for an apology and a recognition that this CIA search of computers used by its oversight committee was inappropriate. I have received neither.
That's Senator Dianne Feinstein. For the last 5 years, members of her staff have been looking into the controversial detention and interrogation program the agency ran after 9/11. In a 38-minute speech, Feinstein claimed the CIA had blocked her investigation and even searched staffers' computers, possibly violating the law.
I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution.
Some have gone so far as to call this a constitutional crisis. Senator Feinstein said it was a defining moment for the legislative branch's oversight of the CIA. Mark Mazzetti is a national security correspondent for the New York Times and the author of The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. He says the Senate investigation started in 2009, just after President Obama came into office, officially ending the controversial detention and interrogation program.
And what the Senate basically set out to do was tell the history of the program and answer questions like, did any of these interrogation methods work? Did they produce any valuable intelligence? And exactly who was telling who what during this whole process inside the government about this program?
Even without the benefit of the report, we do know a fair amount about the program. What do we know?
Well, we know at this point the methods that the CIA used to try to extract information from al-Qaeda detainees. Some of those methods included waterboarding, exposure to extreme temperatures, use of sleep deprivation, and other methods that were approved by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. We also know where most, if not all, of the secret prisons the CIA had, where they were located. There was prisons in Thailand, in Romania, in Jordan, and other places where the CIA had basically made a deal with the local governments in order to keep detainees.
So President Obama takes office in 2009. The detention and interrogation program officially ends at that point, and the Senate begins this investigation into the CIA program. What was the relationship like between the CIA and the congressional investigators?
I mean, I'd say it was pretty fraught from the beginning. A deal was struck between Dianne Feinstein, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and CIA Director Leon Panetta in order for them to get these documents. But the CIA was not making anyone available to be interviewed in person, in part because there was this ongoing investigation into actual criminal activities in the program. The other problem was that the Republicans on the committee pulled out of this investigation early on, in part because they began to think that it was going to be very one-sided, it was going to be an effort to smear the Bush administration. I think it should be noted that that's really what so much of this is about. It's a fight over who writes the history and how this very controversial period of American history is framed.
So you mentioned the relationship between the CIA and this congressional investigation. It's been fraught since the beginning, but still, we've not heard anything like what we heard this week. And however you describe Senator Feinstein, nobody would call her a flamethrower when it comes to stuff like this.
No, I mean, she's been enormously supportive of intelligence agencies during her time as chairwoman of the Intelligence Committee. Really, I mean, all of the backroom jostling I described pales in comparison to what's happened in the last few months, where the CIA came to believe or think that maybe the Intelligence Committee had gained unauthorized access to parts of CIA computers and carried out a search of the computers used by the staff, and therefore the staff turning around and alleging that the CIA was spying on them. And that was what Senator Feinstein earlier this week was talking about, this really constitutional issue of separation of powers and oversight, and whether the CIA is trying to thwart an investigation by its congressional overseers.
Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times. Jane Harman served as one of those congressional overseers of the CIA. She's a former congresswoman and held a leading position on the House Intelligence Committee in the time after 9/11. I asked her if, while she served, the CIA provided enough information for Congress to keep a check on the country's spies.
Well, it's an uneven story. The answer is yes and no. Certainly when Leon Panetta was the director of the CIA, he was very forthcoming. I think his successors have had a harder time.
And so has it varied dramatically from director to director or between administrations?
Yes. Well, all of this is personal. It varies with the personalities on Capitol Hill. It varies with whether it's campaign season or not. It varies with the subject matter, and it certainly varies with who the director of CIA is. Institutionally, this should be a very forthcoming relationship. I think the country benefits when there are checks and balances over what our intelligence activities are. We need to protect classified information, but we also need to be sure that what the founding fathers and mothers designed for this country, which is checks and balances on unfettered executive power, operate.
Well, with the restrictions on what can be released, do you think that the American people will ever have a full accounting of what the CIA did after 9/11?
Well, I think what Dianne Feinstein is trying to do is give an accounting. When you say full accounting, I think that there will be classified portions of that Senate report if it's ever released. And I think that's okay. I think what she intends is to understand that chapter and to learn from it. And certainly, I was one who then, as ranking member, wrote a letter, since declassified, to the general counsel of the CIA questioning whether there had been any form of White House review over the interrogation practices that I had just been briefed on, and cautioning the CIA not to destroy any videotapes, which I'd heard had been made. And we later learned that the videotapes were destroyed. And I still don't know, and I don't know whether we will ever learn about what the White House role was in deciding what kinds of interrogation practices would occur in the first term of Bush 43.
Based on the charges that Senator Feinstein made, can you talk about what the legal implications would be here for the CIA? People are talking about violations of federal law and the Constitution.
I don't know what they might be. I think this has to play out. Unfortunately, it's distracting attention from important activities that the Senate and House Intelligence Committee should be focused on and that our intelligence community should be focused on. I can't think of a more dangerous time in recent memory. And if we have our intelligence community distracted by things like this, we really put the country at risk, and that worries me a great deal.
Former Congresswoman Jane Harman. She's now the president of the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. CIA Director John Brennan has denied Senator Feinstein's charges, and the Justice Department is now investigating. I want to take you back exactly 3 years to March 15, 2011. It was the height of the Arab Spring. In Damascus, hundreds of young Syrians protested in the streets for the first time. They wanted democracy and freedom of expression, and they wanted President Bashar al-Assad out. Over the next 2 weeks, hundreds turned to thousands in marches across Syria. And then late in March of 2011, Assad's forces opened fire on protesters. It was the beginning of a hideous and protracted civil war. 3 years later, nearly half the population has been displaced. 2 million refugees have fled the country. Nigel Timmons is the deputy humanitarian director for the aid group Oxfam. I asked him to reflect on how the war has affected the lives of ordinary Syrians he's met.
meeting people who had come out of Syria, talking to them about their experiences, one of the things that has repeatedly struck me is how, you know, these people like you and I, you know, but for the grace of God, this could be, these were people who had careers and pension plans, had bank accounts. They had watched disasters in other countries on TV. They never thought it would happen to them.
You've written about some of the Syrians you've met over the course of this conflict. Can you talk about a woman you call Sabine? It's a pseudonym, though, that you use for her own safety.
Yeah, that's right. I met her in Jordan in the refugee camp and went into where they were staying, like a little caravan. And I noticed as I sat down, there was a very small baby, just, you know, a matter of weeks old on the cushion next to me. So I just asked her about, you know, gosh, you know, sort of how old is she and so on. And she explained a story. And essentially, they had been at home in a village when shelling had started in their area. The house immediately next door got hit by a shell and was damaged. And they said, enough, we have to leave. We have to leave now. So they literally fled at night. They had three other children, what they could carry. And she was very heavily pregnant. They made it to a nearby village, just a few miles down the road. And while she was there, she went into labor, only with her husband to help sort of deliver the baby. But then the fighting, the front line shifted and the shelling came to that community as well. And so they explained how within 24 hours of her being in labor, they were on the run again, off to somewhere else to try and get away from the fighting. And it just really struck me because I'm a father myself, and I know sort of going through childbirth with my wife, the sense of desperation and fear you must have to make the choice to run when you're so soon after going through labor. And I think we often underestimate what a profound decision it is to make yourself a refugee, to choose to leave your country, to cross a border without a passport and a visa, but just to sort of put yourself on the mercy of the authorities of another country. It's a profound decision.
Oh. Nigel, you've talked about how the humanitarian concerns have shifted and varied over the course of the past 3 years. At this moment now, 3 years into the conflict, what is the most urgent humanitarian concern that you have?
I think it's for many people, they need access to safe water. We're seeing the rise of some diseases in Syria that they haven't seen before. There's been a small outbreak of polio, leishmaniasis, which is a sort of skin-related disease on the growth. But I think it's fundamentally, it's protection. It's an end to the conflict. You know, people are moving because of the shelling, because of the fighting, because of the security concerns. So fundamentally, it's about trying to bring an end to this conflict.
Nigel Timmons is the Deputy Humanitarian Director for Oxfam. Nigel, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Back home, there has been some movement on extending the unemployment benefits that ran out for over 2 million Americans at the end of last year. On Thursday, the Senate finally reached a bipartisan agreement to renew those benefits. The deal would be retroactive to December 28th. That was when Congress failed to extend the emergency benefits program for Americans who have been out of work for at least 6 months. But yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner said he thinks the Senate deal isn't feasible. What happens next in the Republican-run House is up in the air. Meanwhile, those who have lost their benefits are trying to find ways to get by.
My savings is almost gone, so anything that I had around the house that I didn't need that was valuable, I've tried to sell, and I've been pretty successful, but I don't have much left to sell. So.
That's from a phone conversation we had in January with Amy Roberts from Columbus, Ohio. She had been out of work for 9 months and was walking dogs and organizing people's closets to make money.
Really, my full-time job was looking for a job, searching and applying and interviewing.
Then last month, she got an offer, an HR manager for a landscape design firm. Her job? Hiring new employees.
It's such a huge sense of relief. You know, I can't even describe that. It was, the stress was overwhelming, but almost to a point where it was just kind of numbing. And I was in survival mode. You know, it was just about how am I going to get through this week or this month. And now I don't have that stress. That's all been lifted.
Roberts is one of the lucky ones. 63-year-old Patricia James from Bremerton, Washington, was laid off over a year ago. After unemployment benefits ran dry in December, her car broke down. So she's taking the bus to get around. Getting to interviews in nearby Seattle takes hours.
It makes it almost impossible for me to apply for jobs until I make sure I know that I can get there and how long it will take.
Getting unemployment benefits back would make her life easier.
It might allow me to get my car fixed. things would look a lot brighter. I would prefer to work. I don't like having to depend on public assistance to get by.
But for now, she says it would get her back on her feet. Patricia James isn't giving up hope.
Let's just say I'm determined.
The Senate will revisit the agreement after a week-long recess later this month. This week, 105 legislators presented a letter to Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, urging him to change a relatively obscure uniform policy. Dr. Kamal Khalsi is a major in the U.S. Army. He'd signed up for the reserves back in 2001, 7 months before 9/11. Dr. Khalsi is a Sikh. He wears a turban and has a full beard. Both are essential articles of his faith. But they posed a problem when he wanted to volunteer for active duty in 2009. Dr. Khalsi's turban and beard break the uniform and grooming rules for the Department of Defense. It used to be the DOD allowed religious exemptions to the rule, but that changed in the 1980s, and the new rules were not friendly to Sikhs.
A turban and beard interfere with uniformity, possibly may interfere with unit cohesion, and may pose a safety hazard.
Since then, observant Sikhs who wish to serve in active duty must apply for special accommodation. Kamal Khalsi was the first Sikh to do so.
It was an amicable process between myself and my superiors and the Army, but it was a pretty monster task. It took nearly 15,000 petitioners on a letter to then-Defense Secretary Gates. It took 50 congressional signatures. It took pressure from the White House, you know, major law firm, then a civil rights advocate group to get one soldier in.
Since you got your accommodation in 2010, there have been two other Sikhs who have been accommodated and they're serving. Is there an application process like yours, or has it changed at all?
Well, it improved incrementally with each accommodation. So Captain Ruthen, who is a dentist, is currently serving on active duty at Fort Bragg. And then similarly, Corporal Lamba, who is an enlisted soldier, his process, although having still took several months, was a little bit quicker. But the fact remains that this laborious process remains a barrier to Sikh serving. It creates a bit of a chilling effect on those that wish to serve. More recently, DOD came out with a new instruction that attempted to clarify some of these issues with regards to religious apparel. It doesn't really fix the situation for Sikhs. It sort of codifies what's been done thus far, but there's a bit of a catch-22 with the guidelines the way they're written right now. The Army will allow you in, pending your accommodation request, but you are expected to adhere to the current guidelines while your accommodation request is pending. So Sikhs would, in essence, be required to remove their turbans and shave their beards while the religious accommodation request for their turbans and beard is being considered, which is unacceptable to us. Furthermore, and this includes myself, even once you've served, you've deployed, accommodations are revocable at any time. Even now, even today, if I go to a different base or even if I'm deployed once again, I have to apply yet again for the accommodation request.
I'm hoping you could explain this more for people, because to someone of Indian background or even British background, it sounds really strange to hear of Sikhs being excluded from the military. In India and other countries, Sikhs serve disproportionately, and there's a really proud military tradition. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're right on the money with regards to the military tradition. I'm fourth-generation military myself. My great-grandfather was in the Royal British Army. My grandfather and father both served honorably in the Indian Air Force, and today I serve in the U.S. Army. You know, this is a very common story. Many, many Sikhs have such a long history of military service. In Britain, in Canada, and in India, if a Sikh wants to join, they simply, you know, walk up to the recruiter's office and sign up. In the United States today, that process is broken.
What Kamal Khalsi and other Sikhs want from the military is a chance to prove themselves.
It's one thing to have an academic discussion about diversity and my turban and beard are not a problem, but it's a whole other thing to just sort of show up on the doorstep and prove it.
Dr. Kamal Khalsi is a major in the U.S. Army. Welcome to the Kids Table. Here at All Things Considered, we've created a place to sit down and talk about, well, kids, and everything to do with being a parent. And it's impossible to be a parent today without managing your kids' media consumption. Believe me, that is not easy. And it seems there's a new device every month. The American Academy of Pediatrics has guidelines about how much TV time is too much, which is great, but so last century. Parents now, we're worried about the iPad. Are all those apps good for little brains? Dr. Dimitri Christakis is a pediatrician, and he spent a lot of time researching kids and media. He says the thing to look out for is how your kids are interacting with the device.
One thing that children of all ages never say or never even think when they interact with passive media is, I did it. Because, of course, you don't do anything when you watch a screen. But you do do things when you interact with a touchscreen device. And children of all ages, but especially young children, are very, very keen to interact with their environment and make something happen. It's an essential part of their learning and, frankly, of their brain development.
And you draw distinctions within a medium, say, in television. There's a big difference for you between, say, watching the Powerpuff Girls and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
No, that's absolutely right. One of the things that we have found in our study of young children in media is that a lot of the problems are associated with what we call overstimulation. The medium can be too fast. It's surreally paced, and that can overstimulate and ultimately damage young brains.
One of the things that was really fascinating in your work was that you talked about how, well, the effect that we can see of hyperstimulation on mice.
Right. It's funny. There's only so much you can do with live infants. We can't bring them into the lab and overstimulate them for many years watching fast-paced programs and look at the effects on their brain. And so we've developed a mouse model of overstimulation using, if you will, mouse TV. And we find that overstimulated mice who watch television excessively during their childhood, have real deficits in their cognition. In fact, they're hyperactive, and they take all kinds of risks that normal mice wouldn't take.
But not in a heroic good way we might think about.
No, they spend way too much time, for example, in the middle of an open field, which is a very dangerous thing to do as a mouse because you have very few friends in the natural world.
There's been a lot of research on the effects of television, but iPads and tablets, they're fairly new. Do we have any research so far?
We have to take a step back and remind ourselves that iPads are only 4 years old, and most of us can't even conceive of a world that existed before iPads. They feel like they've been here forever. And unfortunately, the pace of research is much, much slower than the pace of technological advances. And so in making my recommendation to parents now, I'm relying on the best available evidence and, frankly, a strong theoretical framework, which suggests that judicious use of these touchscreen technologies, I think, is fine and may even be beneficial. And incidentally, I should also point out that there's no reason whatsoever that a caregiver can't use an app with their child. It's a great opportunity for what we call joint attention, the interactions between a child and a caregiver, the back and forth, which is critical, not just to language development, but to brain development.
So sort of the way that you would with a book with your child. It's the two of you engaging in it together.
Absolutely. In fact, that's really what reading with your child does. It provides an opportunity for you two to interact. And all of the back and forth that goes on there can happen with a touchscreen device. And in fact, maybe even more so, depending on the design of the app.
Dr. Dimitri Christakis is a pediatrician who studies the effects of screen time on young kids. Dr. Christakis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now to the mystery that has captured the world's attention, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which has been missing for a week now. Today there are new details, but even more mystery. Malaysia's Prime Minister, Najib Razak, said evidence now indicates the plane was intentionally diverted and its communication system switched off.
These movements are consistent with deliberate action by someone on the plane.
A deliberate action, not an accident. But he says there are still many unanswered questions.
Despite media reports that the plane was hijacked, I wish to be very clear. We are still investigating all possibilities.
Authorities are now investigating passengers and crew, and the search for Flight 370 continues, but in a new and much larger area. 239 people were on board that flight. Their families and friends are trapped in a state of suspense, unable to answer that crucial question, could my loved one still be alive? Dr. Pauline Boss works with people who have a missing loved one. She's the author of Loss, Trauma, and Resilience, and a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota. When we spoke this week, she had just talked with therapists in Malaysia, working with the families of the missing. I asked Dr. Boss about her advice.
One of the first things you want to tell families like this is that what you're experiencing is an ambiguous loss, and it's the most painful kind of loss there is right now because you have no assurance of the fate of your loved one. And then I add this, it's not your fault. And I add that line because most people who suffer from this kind of loss tend to blame themselves. I should not have told her to go on this flight. I should have gone on this flight myself instead of her. All of these kinds of things go through the minds of the people left behind. And so it's very important to tell them repeatedly, it's not your fault.
When you have that degree of uncertainty, how do you know how to move forward with coping with that loss?
They aren't going to move forward right now. Right now, they're in a survival mode. Eventually, we will hope with family and community support systems that they can move forward. But the only way I've found that families of the missing move forward is if you allow them to hold the paradox that ambiguity causes. At one moment, they'll say, I think they're at the bottom of the sea. At another moment, they'll say, I think perhaps they're alive on an island somewhere. That is normal. That is natural and typical reactions from ambiguous loss, from not knowing.
How does that last over time? Do the feelings change? Can the ambiguity persist?
Well, the ambiguity persists sometimes for a lifetime, even across generations. The problem is that those of us from very can-do cultures, from very mastery-oriented cultures, are used to having answers to all problems. And this is a case where you'll never have an answer. You might have an answer, but you might not ever have an answer. If that is the case, that you never have an answer, the only option left is to learn to live with the ambiguity. And that's quite a challenge for people who live in a very mastery-oriented culture. However, I've seen it happen over and over again. And what happens when people do learn to embrace the not knowing, they become more resilient and stronger for it.
What can people do to support those who are going through this kind of ambiguous loss?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question, because society is really rough on the families of the missing. They don't understand quite what to do. And unfortunately, what people tend to do, therefore, is stay away. Please don't stay away from these families. But there isn't much you have to say to them. Your presence will be support enough in many cases. Our validation, the validation of society for ambiguous loss, is essential for people to move forward.
That's Pauline Boss. She's a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota, and she joined us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Dr. Boss, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Today, the Malaysian defense minister announced the authorities were refocusing their investigation on all crew and passengers. Last week, Interpol confirmed that two passengers aboard the flight were traveling on stolen passports. While there's no evidence that those passengers are behind the plane's disappearance, aviation experts say it highlights a major security gap at many airports. It is still possible to board an airplane with a fake photo ID. How could that be the case? A new study of facial recognition finds that people are shockingly bad at picking out fake photo IDs. Megan Papish is one of the authors of that study.
When you are tasked with matching somebody to a photo ID that had been taken days, months, even years prior, all of the many changes that occur, people gain weight, lose weight, shave, put on glasses, you know, myriad changes occur, and that makes people really willing to accept a lot of changes.
So how did you do the study? How did you take a look at this?
We took pictures of students at Arizona State University and got their permission to download their student ID photos. And then at Louisiana State University, we presented those photos to students and asked them to make basically mismatch decisions to those, where we manipulated how frequently we showed them IDs that mismatched. So those are the critical ones. Those are the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. And how often did they get it wrong?
Well, when they see the mismatches frequently, so that's 50% of the time, they would get it wrong about 20% of the time. So they would be about 80% accurate. But when they only saw the mismatches 10% of the time, their error rates actually skyrocketed. They went up to 45%.
Just for some real-world examples, say if you're a bouncer at a bar, you're checking IDs, are you more or less likely to get those right compared to other situations?
That situation is actually really interesting. So a lot of my research assistants have told me that bouncers at clubs are really good at spotting fake IDs, despite the motivation to let people in and sell alcohol to them, because they encounter so many of them, which is part of why we're interested in providing training to individuals who are tasked with doing this in more security contexts with those bursts of fake IDs, kind of like they would get if they were bouncers at a club.
So TSA agents could learn something from the bouncer community.
I hesitate to put them on that spot, but it's possible.
And in terms of the ID itself, is there anything that can be done with that or photographic techniques that could make them less fallible?
Well, I hear for passport photos, you have to put your hair behind your ears if you have long hair, because most people don't change their ears. But driver's licenses don't have those sort of constraints. But there are some researchers in the UK that have found that having multiple photos of the same person helps people identify faces to photographs.
You know, I know that we know from computer modeling that facial recognition is extremely complicated, and your work would seem to indicate that humans actually aren't as good at it as we might have thought we were. Is this simply a bad way to identify people?
Unfortunately, it's simultaneously the best and the worst way that we have. Computer face recognition software is making tremendous strides. But unfortunately, that software doesn't perform at the level of humans yet, so it can't be deployed in applied contexts. And barring anything much more invasive, like retinal scans or thumbprint ID, face matching is really the best way to go without being too terribly invasive.
Megan Papesh's most recent study is about the reliability of photo ID recognition. Megan, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. World music DJ Beto Arcos is a frequent guest of this program, and he's noticed a curious trend recently, something that he likes to call musical encounters. Without further ado, I want to bring him in. Beto, again, welcome.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Arun.
Always a pleasure to have you. So first, tell us about this music you've brought. What's the unifying theme here?
What I find really kind of a confluence of sounds and traditions here is that you have musicians who are originally based in the Middle East or come from the Middle East, specifically Lebanon, Syria, and Tunisia, and they're coming together with musicians from the Western part of the world, specifically from Europe. So the very first one is this incredible new recording by the fantastic composer, musician, educator, a man who's really like a Renaissance man of the 21st century, Jordi Savall.
Now, people may not be familiar with Jordi Savall, but he is, this is how I know him, he's a legend, a living legend in the early music movement that really recovered a lot of old European music and restored the performing practices.
That's correct. This is a piece that comes from his record titled Orient Occident Volume 2. It's a tribute, really, an homage to Syria. Because of what's been going on in the past couple of years in Syria, he really felt the need to do something to call attention to not just the musical traditions, but the people that are from that region. And he brought together musicians from that whole region, from Lebanon, from Israel, and other parts of the Mediterranean, and Syrian musicians to record music that takes us back centuries to the golden age of Syrian culture.
I guess there's a connection there that would make sense with early music, because isn't the lute really comes from the Middle East originally, right? Wasn't it the oud?
Originally, the oud was created in Iraq, but of course, it's traveled throughout the Middle East, ending up in Spain, where it was transformed into a guitar.
Right. That's Jordi Savall and Hesperian 21 with a piece from their latest, Orient Occident 2, a tribute to Syria. Beto, what else do you have for us?
This is a singer from Lebanon who lives in Paris. Her name is Yasmin Hamdan.
That's pretty. I'm not sure how to place that music, what kind of music that is.
Well, interestingly, she's singing an old song from the 1940s by a Lebanese writer named Omar El Zeni. And I have to tell you a little bit of the lyrics. The lyrics go like this. Let's cut the recurring rhetoric. Every other day, a new political party. Stop the bell sounding and the feather ruffling. Your peacock days are over.
I wasn't expected to be quite so pointed, given how it sounds, how relaxed and...
It almost sounds like a love song, but it's a song that was written, I imagine, around the 40s when things were in upheaval in this part of the world, in Lebanon. She's an up-and-coming singer. She was part of another group called Soap Kills, a duo. She moved to Paris, and she's collaborating with French musicians in this new music scene in Paris. So she's adding this sort of French pop flavor to her sound, but she's still keeping close to her roots. She's singing, in fact, there are a couple of songs here she sings that are classic old songs from the Arab world.
That's new music from Yasmin Hamdan. The album is called Ya Nas. Beto, we have time for one more.
This is an amazing record. It's by a trumpet player originally from Lebanon. When he was about 8 or 9 years old, his family moved to Paris. He went to the music conservatory. His name is Ibrahim Malouf.
So Beto, you know I'm an old trumpet player, so I know a bit about this guy. He's got quite a pedigree. Like, you know, he's played classical music, and his dad studied with Maurice André, which for trumpet geeks is, that's the man.
And in my opinion, he's the man.
Yes, he is.
Ibrahim is the man. This guy is about 30-something years old. He has 5 records. This is his 5th. And he is reimagining this trumpet that his father invented with quarter tones.
It's got an extra valve on it, so you can play quarter tones, like Arab music.
That's right. It's not a typical trumpet with 3 vowels. It has 4 vowels, and that's the 4th vowel that adds that quarter tone.
This reminds me of, this is for jazz geeks, but Don Ellis, another guy who added a valve to his trumpet, played quarter tones, had a big band, and had this other kind of crazy big band sound, sort of like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I've seen, you know, comments about people saying that, yeah, well, you know, maybe Ibrahim's dad invented it in the Middle East, but Don Ellis did it here in the U.S. too. I said, well, you know what? It's possible that they might have done it at the same time and they'd never met each other.
A good idea is a good idea.
That's right. But I think what he's doing, Ibrahim, is really pushing forward this instrument that is typically used, associated with classical Arab music. Now he's doing something else. This is funk.
It's an awesome sound. The music is by Ibrahim Malouf. The DJ is Beto Arcos. He's the host of Global Village on KPFK in Los Angeles. Go to our website to hear a little more from all the selections we just enjoyed. That's nprmusic.org. Beto, this was awesome as always. Thank you.
My pleasure, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
Here at All Things Considered, we're collecting stories of triumph, big and small, moments when people make great leaps forward in their careers. We call it My Big Break. You probably don't know the name June Ambrose, but you may have seen her work.
I am the girl who put Puff Daddy in a shiny suit. I am the girl who put Nas in a pink suit and white shoes. I am also the girl who put Will Smith in a hibiscus suit head to toe.
Before her days as a stylist to the stars, she worked in costume design for music videos. Her break came when she was called in to work on Missy Elliott's hit, The Rain.
Well, when I first sat down with the record label for Missy Elliott, it was to discuss the Super Duper Fly album project. The head of the record label called me in for a meeting, along with Missy and her management team. The question was posed to me, how are you, June Ambrose, going to sell this young lady to mainstream America? She was a full-figured girl, and at the time it was all about racy, provocative females in music. The lyrical content was very racy, and it was almost an animated racy. I said, Missy Elliott will be my modern-day cartoon character. Music video director Hype Williams came to me with this amazing video treatment that talked about Missy Elliott being blown up in this, what he described as like a Michelin man. Me, I'm super fly, super duper fly, super duper fly. I said, oh, like a big white blow up bubble? Like the tire commercials? And I just saw it so differently. I said, well, I would love to use black patent leather. And I designed this big blow up suit out of a tire inner tube and patent leather on the outside, like more of a vinyl. The contraption was very small, deflated, but once you blew it up, it was the size of maybe a 900-pound man. And we had to take the suit to a gas station to have it blown up. So we walked to the gas station, we blew her up, and then we walked her back to location where we were shooting. And the suit slowly deflated. It had a small leak. Now, with the way this costume was built, any bit of air that seeped out would not keep the suit inflated. So now I'm like, oh God, what am I gonna do? Everyone was screaming, get art department, let's figure this out. I was like, I need a bicycle pump. This is a Missy Elliott exclusive. And the director would yell, action. Little me, I'm behind this big inflated suit. And I'm just pumping, 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 pumping as she's dancing. I stood behind the suit during every take, keeping the air pressure in the suit, but just allowing enough of it to seep out so that it would pop lock in a way that was just so dynamic. The slight leak actually made the suit a lot more dynamic than I could have ever imagined. And that crazy luck, I gotta tell you, probably changed my life. I earned my wings. If she was skeptical before this experience, she now knew that she could trust me. And I did every music video in her career after that. I think Missy Elliott was really when my big break happened. These outrageous music video moments, because they were so highly recognized and celebrated, they caught on. We never came from behind the curtains. We were the wizards. But people always want to seek out who's creating magic.
June Ambrose, a celebrity stylist who's worked on more than 150 music videos. We want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to mybigbreak@npr.org. A romantic getaway in Paris that goes awry. Sounds like the perfect material for a movie comedy, almost a cliché. Not so much if the couple in question is a pair of cranky, 60-something English academics, arguing about everything from sex to spending habits.
Well, I think we've earned a very good time.
You know I'm anxious about money.
We might live for ages as a burden to others.
I've taken up Zumba. I'm redesigning my body.
Why? Who's going to see it?
That's Jim Broadbent and Lindsay Duncan as Nick and Meg in Le Weekend. It's the fourth collaboration between acclaimed writer Hanif Qureshi and director Roger Michel, who directed Notting Hill. Like two of their previous films, The Mother and Venus, Le Weekend focuses on the intimate lives of older people. As he's gotten older, Hanif Qureshi says he's become more fixated on those stories.
When I had kids, I began to look at the world from a different point of view. And I realized there was, in a sense, more material in older people that I didn't, in a way, want to write about kids as I had done in, say, The Buddha of Suburbia, My Beautiful Laundrette, and so on. And the lives of older people are not normally portrayed much in the cinema. Most people who have sex in most films are having sex for the first time. It suddenly occurred to me and Raj to think about what would it be like to make love to somebody who you've made love to already for 30 years. And I suddenly saw that there was an audience for serious films that was not really being catered to.
We could try taking our lovemaking into another dimension.
What did you have in mind?
I thought we could pretend to be other people.
It's an extremely intimate film, but it's a side of people, I think, especially couples that have been together that long, that you don't really see very often in film, really exposing their passions in a way you don't generally see.
Well, as a writer, it was a great challenge to do because there's not a lot going on. There are no bangs or cars or crashes or big noises or anything. And it's about something that Roger and I thought was really important to write about, which was why be with somebody else? What do you have to give up, you might say, in order to be in this relationship? And during the weekend, they try and figure out what they're doing together or what they want from one another and so on. So it's a comedy, I guess. There's some bitterness in it because there are a sort of history of resentments, let's say, between them.
And some of the comedy comes out of some of the bitterness.
Well, Roger and I wanted to make a film that was really about people who would switch pretty quickly between loathing one another and between loving one another.
This is it, isn't it, my love? This is where I want to be forever.
You always did edit out the arguments and the misery.
You talk a bit about the collaboration process with Roger Michel, because obviously the collaboration must work well since you've done this several times now. Do you come up with ideas together? Do you write first and then you come to him?
All of those things, actually, at once. I mean, I would have an idea, and I'd give it to Roger, and Roger would say that was a terrible idea. Then I'd write some stuff down, and he'd say, most of this is terrible, but there are three scenes that I really like. And actually, we're rather like the couple in Le Weekend, in the sense that we argue and fall out, and then we do something really good together, and then he has a tantrum and so on. But it's a really good collaboration, because actually, in the end, something really good comes out of the disputes and the debates we have together. It seems to me that we're doing stuff together that we couldn't do separately.
And you compared yourself to the old married couple in Le Weekend. Did I hear correctly that the film was actually inspired by a trip the two of you took to Paris?
Roger and I did a sort of research trip together. And we stayed, as the couple do, in a rather run-down, crummy hotel. You know, we are like a married couple. We argue all the time and we never have sex.
Is it difficult to get backing for, you know, this is a film, like you said, not only does it not have explosions, but it's really centered on the passions, the love life of older people. It's got a pacing that's kind of uncommon for films these days. How do you guys get backing for these films?
You can make these films if you make them cheap. And if you get really good actors and you don't pay them very much, but they want to do it because they like the parts. And the other thing you need is a really good script, a really good story. And they'll want to be in it. So if you can get all those ingredients going at once, you can get your money back.
I'm trying to think of what it must be like for a writer to be able to toggle back and forth between being in total control the way you are in a novel and in this very collaborative process. It doesn't seem like it'd be easy to switch back and forth, but it's something you've been doing for a while.
It's a tough compromise. It's a real hustle being a professional writer. I'm amazed at my age, I'm nearly 60 now, that I've managed to make a living as a member of an ethnic minority in Britain, as a writer, for most of my life. It seems to me, looking back, there's a sort of incredible achievement. So I do all of these things because some of them sponsor the other things I want to do.
You mentioned you've already been having conversations with Roger about future projects.
Yeah.
Any preview you can give us about what we might see in the next several years?
I want to write a story about two women, two friends, and one of them goes out on a date and meets a man and begins a very hot sexual relationship with this man. And the story is really going to be about how her pleasure affects her friend and the rest of her family. And Roger and I are beginning to work on this. But you never know with Roger. He's a difficult fellow. It may not work out at all. It's easy to have an idea. And in fact, it's easy to have a good idea. But to really develop it and to see whether this idea is going to hold up is another matter. So what we writers do is spend a lot of time throwing stuff away. You need to make a lot of material just to find a little bit of gold you might then be able to make into something for an audience.
Hanif Qureshi's latest collaboration with Roger Michel is Les Weekends. It's out now in select theaters. Hanif Qureshi, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
For the week ending March 16th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo DeLaguila. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.